The following program has been pre-recorded.
Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisquintas.
We gather here once a week at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. We talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions, and we get by.
Yes, we are opinionated.
We are. Oh, no. And we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. For more information, go to themuckyduckpub.com or call the pub and ask for Marcus.
The following is an encore presentation of the Donalana Kitchen. Enjoy. We're here around the kitchen table to talk about food in central Iowa and food around our kitchen table. We'll talk today about some French things, maybe a little bit about a brand new, really exciting cookie book that we ran across.
Yum, yum, yum.
And we have an herb of the week, and I may get around to talking about some kolaches. Oh, for those of you who know about kolaches, you can help us out here, yes. Kolaches. So, this radio program, the Donalana Kitchen, is made possible by support from some nice folks.
Yes, support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames. Community-owned, community-focused since 1974. Open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
And we do. So, what did you do this weekend, Donna?
Well, I think what you did was more interesting. You did some blueberry shopping, as
oh,
it were.
Oh, I did. It's blueberry season. So I did alert.
And a good one, too, I hear.
Yes, a very good one. And I did alert Donna, and I'm alerting everybody else out there that this is sort of the start of the blueberry picking. And blueberries will go on for a bit. I do like blueberries because they're relatively easy to pick. And the people at the Berry Patch over south of Nevada do a wonderful job of growing them. And if you have blueberries in your backyard, you should have blueberries for a while. They come in sort of stages.
Well, and they're also easy. You don't really have to clean them very much. No. Like the strawberries, you have to take the stems off. The gooseberries, which I love, are really tedious. You have to pick those little tiny twizzles off the end. I mean, blueberries are just great for large things. You don't have to peel them.
Blueberries are a very user-friendly sort of berry,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
They're very good and easy to pick. And I went out to the berry patch and picked lots this past, I think I went out on Friday. It was a beautiful day. I call ahead and make sure that they are open for picking because they have a picking window there. They're very good about mob grazing out there. There were so many people picking, but it's
were
very
there lots
organized.
Of children? It's a
yes,
very great
was.
Place to take children.
It was. The berry bushes are probably about, well, as high as my head, but if you kind of look over them, and there were little heads all over the place, people running up and down. And what was kind of nice is the chatter in between the bushes. We sort of seemed like a flock of birds chattering our way. Everybody's got an opinion, of course, and the kids are saying, can we go home now? But it's just a wonderful thing. Plus, the birds were singing, and it was pretty lovely. So I also made a blueberry pie because I love blueberry pies. And only...
Oh, I'm getting hungry. That does.
Only make one, you know, one or two a year because I like them.
Strikes a chord in one's heart.
They're so good. I must say my crust turned out beautifully, but...
Butter?
Once again,
butter crust.
Butter. I did half butter and half coconut oil.
Oh,
huh? Because
okay.
Coconut oil is sort of it hardens up or it has what do you mm-hmm. call it? It's hydrogenated. It's like butter.
Right.
It's not runny.
Right. I forgot what that kind of.
Anyway,
yeah, right. It works.
Half and half worked absolutely beautifully for the crust, but once again, I had to eat my blueberry pie with a spoon because it was too runny. And I have a little complaint. I followed to a T the recipe in the Joy of Cooking for their berry pie. They had two options for thickening up your blueberry pie. One was using cornstarch. The other was using tapioca. I opted for the cornstarch. I followed the recipe, and it was still runny. So I don't know why. If anybody knows why, send me an email.
I assume that our blueberries are juicier and plumper.
That must be it. It's not a bad thing to eat your blueberry pie with a spoon.
It also proves that even the most perfect recipes, like Joy of Cooking, which is my standard, they're quite fallible because there's so many variations possible in natural mm-hmm. ingredients.
Right. When you say take 4 cups of berries, and this was a generic berry recipe, so I suppose it could have been blackberries or gooseberries.
Maybe your idea of a cup of berries is slightly, I mean, come on, how do you actually measure a cup of berries?
Right.
You could have been very generous with your cups.
I tend to be generous.
Yes, you
do. And you're right, it might have something to do with mm-hmm. with the juiciness of things. But again, there's no such thing as a bad piece of blueberry pie. So get out there and enjoy the fruit of the season. It's a very nice thing to do.
And if you don't want to make a pie,
yeah,
you can just do, I mean, obviously you can make muffins. And if you don't want to bake, because it's hot, blueberry sauce on vanilla ice cream. It's so easy. You just put the blueberries in the pan. You add a little bit of sugar, a little bit of water, and a little bit of cornstarch.
Okay.
Cook them up. And, of course, that can vary in its runniness, you know, because you're going to eat it with a spoon anyway. But that's a great way to use those blueberries without having to really do much of anything.
Ooh. Or then they're just eating them fresh. So
yes.
Very good. It's blueberry season. We also have to talk today. I brought a show and tell, or show and smell, I should say. Show and smell. I have something here that I have grown for many years, and I'm learning to use it. It's called holy basil, or sacred basil, or tulsi.
Is it, strictly speaking, a basil?
It is a basil, but it's a little different than the kind of Italian basil. Well, I suppose you could, but I find it much more floral to the nose and what it's used for.
It's very traditional medicinal, in Ayurvedic medicine,
yes.
among other things, which is Indian.
Yes, it's called tulsi, and actually you may have found it in some teas. There's tulsi tea, T-U-L-S-I.
Oh, you can even get supplements of tulsi basil.
Yes,
in a lot of herbal formulations.
Yes, it's venerated as a holy plant in India and in Hindu worship, and it has many medicinal properties. I like it. It smells absolutely lovely, and as a tea, it seems to be very calming. I used to drink chamomile tea, and I didn't care for the taste of chamomile all that much, but it's nice to have a little cup of something hot before you go to bed. And I discovered this tulsi tea, and it is a stress reliever.
That is its primary mm-hmm. quality. I think it's kind of could be classified in terms of tonic.
Yes.
It does a lot of good things for you.
Yes, it does. It does. It used to treat colds and coughs and sore throats, and there's people use it for kidney stones and heart disorders, skin disorders. And here's a good one. The herb is useful in teeth disorders. You can use its dried leaves, and you can brush your teeth with it. It refreshes bad breath and cleans your teeth.
My goodness, it does a little of everything.
It does a little bit of everything.
I think it just straightens you out from the inside out, right?
It does. It does. Anyway, it's a pretty plant to grow, too. The plant itself looks very basil-ish, but I find the leaves are a little grayer looking, dustier looking, with a nice little purple flower. According to my research, there's also a reddish-green sort of leaf, spotted leaf you can get too. I have grown that in the past too, but my holy basil this year is just dusty green, very pretty, very prolific.
Now, since it's a basil, would that put it in the mint family?
I suppose.
Probably.
It is a basil. And I just cut mine off, leaving a little bit of the plant because it will come back. And I
Is this dehydrator?
I put it in my food dryer, in my dehydrator, and just dehydrated the stuff. And I will use it in tea.
Well, we have such a generally good basil crop this year. Maybe I'll start dehydrating some because I love to preserve homemade basil for all winter long, you know, just dried rather than what one would purchase at the store because it's so much more fragrant.
And actually, here's a tip, too. The more you cut your basil off, it will come back. So instead of letting your basil go to flower, go down in that basil plant and find a node where two leaves or two stems are coming up, where it splits, and then cut down the vertical stem that comes between those two. If you leave a little basil on the plant, about a foot up or a foot up from the ground, it will come back. So enjoy
basil. It'll just keep going.
It will keep going as long as till the frost. It loves heat, so it's doing well this week. Well, we've got something to discuss here, as usual, that is kind of serious, but it's important to know about. A friend told us about an article.
In Esquire magazine, as a matter of fact, and you can just go read it online. It's quite a good article, not too long.
Yes, you can go to, I just Googled Esquire
magazine.
Esquire magazine and climate change, and it's going to be in their August issue. And it really does kind of affect all of us. It's kind of in the back of all of our minds now. It's about scientists and their relationship to the information that they are finding out about what's happening to our planet. The article is called, "When the End of Human Civilization is Your Day Job." Among many climate scientists, gloom has set in. Things are worse than we think, but scientists can't really talk about it.
It's about denial within our culture and how strong it is. And it reminded me a lot of what we did on the show last week because I've been reading a lot about kind of the despair that a lot of people are feeling about the general overall trends of our global civilization and how you deal with that because it is so large. And most people, you know, who are intimately involved in these sort of things, whether they're scientists or activists or even, you know, politicians that want to deal with this, are willing to deal with this, I should say, talk about how difficult it is personally. And I definitely, you know, like if I'm reading late at night some of this stuff that I follow, it's kind of, you think, oh, my grandchildren, you know.
Yes, how to deal
existentially with this. Because, you know, you can't give up, you know. There was a lot of talk at the Prairie Festival last year, too, about the nature of hope. Now, one needs hope. I think it's part of our human psyche, and it's very, very necessary. But hope founded on unrealistic things is, it's rather childish. So this article in Esquire is talking about an American climate scientist, young man, 42 or something, who actually moved with his family to Denmark.
His name is Jason Box. And he moved to Denmark because he was kind of told not to talk about his fears
from Colorado. And there was another woman mentioned in there who moved to England, and she said, even living in England is a relief because the amount of public pressure and just nastiness in the American discourse and the amount of people get life-threatening letters if they write about climate change. Yeah. I mean, we're hard on those scientists.
This climatologist called Jason Box has been roundly forbidden and put down for expressing emotion about what he saw. Scientists aren't supposed to have emotion about this. And because he's a human being, he sort of reacted to what he was finding, and he said, hey, folks, this is important. This is nasty here. And showing emotion was ringed with taboos in all science, but especially in climate science. Climate scientists have been so distracted and intimidated by the relentless campaign against them that now, unfortunately, they tend to avoid any statements that might get them labeled as alarmists. So there they are, they're caught between a rock and a hard place with finding out all of this important information, but people don't want to hear it. And that includes us, I'm afraid.
Yeah, but we're all in the same boat.
Yeah, all these gloomy statements. All these gloomy statements. One person that received a lot of bad feedback was, do you remember the chart, the graph that was first shown as part of Al Gore's movie? When he first brought that out, there was this...
The hockey puck graph.
Where, okay, here's the climate going along in the centuries and the years. And then all of a sudden, it gets warmer and warmer. And all of a sudden, it just shoots right up. And in a sense, when it shoots right up, we pretty much all look at one another and we say, oh, we are dead right there. And that hockey puck graph was discovered and plotted out by a person called Michael Mann, who was a young PhD researcher when he came up with that historical data, the temperatures in the past and how they're...
And the sudden spike.
Yeah, and what he would say, putting all the information he has in here, what's going to happen in the next century or so. Now, you think we'd kind of take that information, okay, so fine, let's talk about this. No.
Let's deal.
It scared a lot. It scared me. But it scared a lot of people, too. He was investigated. He was denounced in Congress, got death threats, was accused of fraud. He received white powder in the mail and got thousands of emails with suggestions like, you should be shot and quartered and fed to pigs, unquote. So he got all kinds of pressure from his university. And a British journalist even suggested the electric chair. Now, this is somebody that plotted out a graph.
A scientist based on his work.
Yeah. So now people, the scientists, this article in Esquire is about the scientists actually having a real emotional and psychological problems because they find out one thing, they turn around and present their work, and they are getting slapped upside the head.
Shoot the messenger.
It is. So I don't know if it's going to do us any good to shoot the messenger. That doesn't mean that the climate is going to change. It's a very, very interesting article. So I'm not advocating going out and buying Esquire magazine, but you can get this kind of stuff online. And it's supposed to be in the August issue of Esquire.
Well, and it does say in the article that a lot of these younger scientists, like the ones that were in graduate school when Al Gore was first talking about this, they're saying, oops, a lot of these predictions that we were making in that time period, which is what, maybe 15 mm-hmm. years ago or something, they have come to pass.
Yeah,
some of these weather changes and raging, you know, and it's pretty, it's very unsettling. Very unsettling.
The sea rising and the things getting warmer and glaciers melting and wildfires. Wildfires seem to be just popping up and trees dying. This is massive stuff here, folks. And so either we deal with the truth or another way to go down would not be, I suppose.
Part of the problem, especially at least in this country, because we are very dominated by the necessity to use fossil fuels.
Yeah.
We have not been given any personal alternatives. Yes, you can recycle and, you know, maybe you drive a little less, mm-hmm. but we've not been given on a personal level really serious ways to mitigate our own personal input. So it's a very helpless feeling. Oh, this is terrible. What do I do?
So we do have to address it as a whole species. And that means that governments have to get into it. Because governments are really us on a big scale. We have to start facing
the truth. And churches? Good for the Pope.
Oh, good for him.
Yes, yes. I think it's an ethical issue. It's a moral issue. It's certainly a spiritual issue. I think maybe our spiritual communities are maybe the most able to be active and to articulate, because certainly that's the place we go with our despair and for a lot of people, mm-hmm. and community organizations, and it's a difficult one.
It's a good idea. So along with all the other stuff we talk about on our kitchen show here, we talk about these things too, because it does affect us. It affects our food.
Affects
and our
families. Food supply big
it
time.
Certainly does. It certainly does.
And then our show last week, which was about carbon sequestration, does point out some things that, particularly here in Iowa, where we do lots of farming, we could be pulling some of that carbon out of the air and putting it back in the soil where it's very happy and does a good job. So we often do this, that, you know, we'll talk about eating blueberries and then the end of the world as we know it. But we all kind of have to live with this dichotomy in our psyche now. You know, it's just the way things are.
So keep that on the back burner, as
and don't
we
forget
say.
To eat your blueberries.
And eat your blueberries, yes. A little more uplifting thing here. I pulled out my book of days. This is the July 14th. It is the runic half month of Ur. Runic half month.
Oh, runic half month of Ur. Okay, got that, guys. The runic half month of from the ruins.
Yeah, Ur.
Runes.
And it's got a picture of a yak here, and it has something to do with collective action and power. And Thor, the hammer-wielding god, it's best applied to projects for the common good.
Hmm.
So it just
does
so
this have
happens.
Anything to do with Grexit and the Iranian? They've reached a nuclear deal.
That's
the hammer of Thor, I guess. Okay, let's take care of business, guys.
Yes, yes. It's using this power of this particular day, and let's get together and do something for the common good. We can do that.
Maybe that's how Bastille Day happened.
Right. So how did Bastille start?
Well, a Bastille is the big old dungeon prison in Paris where, you know, the king used to stick anybody that disagreed with him. And so Bastille Day, which is kind of really like our 4th of July, it's their Independence Day from the monarchy. So the people of Paris just kind of rioted and they tore open the prison gates and leashed the poor unfortunates.
Good.
Who'd been put there. So for all over France on Bastille Day, of course, they have fireworks just like we do, and great traditions of nighttime dancing in the streets, all kinds of folk dances. Paris is usually just all the cafes are open, and every few corners has a bunch of musicians hanging out and all things French celebratory. So
let's get into the mood a little bit with a little French cafe music. Yes, you're listening to KHOI.
Pour se rendre utile et passer à l'action, il suffit juste simplement de s'agiter. Faire les gens qui jouent en évitant les coups qu'on se donne à soi en gesticulant sans arrêt. Les mains toujours au bout des bras, brassent l'air inutilement. À force de remuer, j'ai mal aux mains. À force de traîner les pieds, j'ai mal aux mains. À force de remuer, j'ai mal aux mains. À force de traîner les pieds, j'ai mal aux mains. Je gaspille mon énergie, je multiplie les efforts pour ne pas avoir tort. Être faux pour mieux faire vrai, c'est bien, mais c'est beaucoup de travail pour rien. C'est beaucoup de travail pour rien, et ça fait mal aux mains. À force de remuer, j'ai mal aux mains. À force de traîner les pieds, j'ai mal aux mains. À force de remuer. J'ai mal aux mains, à force de traîner les pieds, j'ai mal aux mains et aux pieds. Thank you. Merci. S'agiter dans tous les sens devient une espèce de sixième sens, c'est bien. Je multiplie les n'importe quoi. Hey, je me fais taper sur les doigts. Faire des pieds et des mains, c'est le pied, mais ça, ça fait mal au bas. Oh,
à force de remuer. J'ai mal aux mains, à force de traîner les pieds, j'ai mal aux mains.
Oh,
à force de remuer. J'ai mal aux mains, à force de traîner les pieds, j'ai mal aux mains. À force de remuer. J'ai mal aux mains, à force de traîner les pieds, j'ai mal aux mains. À force de
That was a little bit of bouncy French cafe music by a singer called Stefan Sansovino. The song is called Mal aux Mains, and what it means is tired hands or sore hands. It's sort of, the song sort of relates to, it's too much work. This is just too much work. So that's kind of what that's about. This, you're listening to KHOI FM 89.1. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Donna is going to do some more French stuff here. We got some French recipes to talk about to celebrate Bastille Day.
They're all desserts, of course, because it's a celebration. So I was just kind of thinking about three sort of very classic French things. And the first one is, of course, madeleines, which are these little French kind of shell-shaped cookies. And they're very easy to make. I really like to make them. The only drawback is they need a formed madeleine pan because it's about the shape of the cookie. And the cookie has to have a shape. It doesn't just like – it's not like a drop cookie or a cut cookie or something like that. But what I like about it is, first of all, they're really best very, very fresh. So I often – like if I'm doing a dinner party – you can make the dough ahead and put it in the refrigerator and have the pans all greased and ready to go. And then you just kind of heat the oven up during the main course. And then that nice pause before you have dessert, I pop them in the oven. And they only take, I don't know, let's see, how long does she say? 8 minutes or something. It's very fast. So this recipe that I use is from Cooking at Home on Rue Tatin, Susan Herman Loomis, who is a lovely old friend of mine. She lives and has done for many years about an hour outside of Paris, where she runs a little French cooking school for Americans and has numerous books on French cooking. And she's a very good French writer. That's a cookbook writer. That's Susan Herman Loomis. And if you want to get really, really French, she has written a book called En Rue Tatin, which is her address. And she talks about moving to France as a family and buying this old abbey and refurbishing it where she now has her cooking school. And it's a wonderful little entertaining read. So her recipe is basically what you do is it's flour and a lot of eggs and sugar and a lot of melted butter. And you whip all that up and then chill it in the fridge and then drop it into the greased madeleine sheet. And so you pop them in the oven and they pop up really, really well. Actually, we should probably post this one on. So it's a cup and a third of flour, a pinch of sea salt, 4 large eggs, and a cup of sugar. She uses vanilla sugar, but I just use vanilla and drop a teaspoon of vanilla in. And 12, a stick and a half of butter, unsalted butter, melted and cooled. So you melt the butter first, cool it, and then you put everything in with a whip it on high speed till it's really, really fluffy.
Fluffy.
Fluffy, yeah. Fluffy. And then you can kind of season these any way you want. She puts hers is with dried lemon verbena, which I love. Vanilla is traditional. You know, it'll take any kind of flavoring that kind of suits your fancy. So that is one French thing that I really, really love. The other classic one that's very good to make in summer and would be great with blueberries is clafoutis, spelled C-L-A-F-O-U-T-I-S. That's a sort of, it's more in the south of France, but it's like a pie with no crust. It's kind of an eggy custard. And so what they do is you kind of grease the pie pan and kind of sprinkle it with sugar, and then you put whatever fruit, plums, cherries, but blueberries would be good too. You just kind of dot them around the bottom of the pan, and then you make this batter, which is a 3/4 cup of flour, little pinch of sea salt, 2 cups of milk, 3 large eggs, 1/4 cup of sugar, not terribly sweet. And then you kind of mix the batter up, pour it over the fruit, dot a little butter on top, sprinkle a little more sugar on, and stick it in the oven. So you end up with a custardy, you know, once it's cooled, it will actually slice. But it's probably a lot less calories because you don't have that butter crust on it. And it's also very quick to make.
Sounds very good with blueberries.
Yeah, I think I might have to make one for dinner. Oh, good. My goodness. And then the third very French thing that's also very American is something I grew up with, cream puffs. French, it's called pâte à choux, which is the dough for the cream puff. My mother was not a very bakey person, although she did lots of pies. The other thing that she did do was she was delighted with cream puffs. And I remember as a very young child, maybe 5 years old, she read to us all of the Raggedy Ann and Andy books. And in the Raggedy Ann and Andy book was a character named Betsy Bonnetstring. And Betsy Bonnetstring had a magic apron. And when she would shake the apron, cream puffs would appear. So my mother used to make us cream puffs. And she always thought it's kind of a wild looking mixture because you're basically beating eggs into butter and flour. And you think it's going to just be glop, and you have to kind of beat the eggs in one at a time until it kind of turns shiny. Now, I just use the Joy of Cooking recipe, and then you drop them onto a cookie sheet and let them rise. But I have to say, in high humidity, they're a little hard to deal with. So if you're going to be cooking them this time of year, be sure you're running the air conditioner or something.
We might as well make use of it while we can.
And you could fill them with ice cream and blueberries.
Oh, very good. They're called cream puffs. Are they usually filled with whipped cream? Is that the idea?
This is it. You can fill them with sweetened yogurt. Pudding is, of course, my favorite. And it's, a chocolate eclair is made from the same, you can shape the cream puff.
Oh.
If you drag it out long, you end up with your eclair. And then you cool them and you kind of cut them open a little bit and you squirt in the pudding or pastry cream, and then you drizzle chocolate on the top, and there you have your chocolate eclair.
That's what a chocolate eclair is.
Or you can put ice cream in them, or you can use the same dough and make like a gougère, which is you put cheese in it, so it's like a little salty, instead of crackers for an appetizer, you have these little miniature savory cheese puff things. The dough is very versatile.
Oh, great. So, and the recipe can be found in the Joy of Cooking.
Joy of Cooking. I think they do. Well, there's, look up cream puff shells or pâte à choux. P-A-T-E is pâte à choux. C-H-O-U-X. Or poof paste also.
Oh.
They call that in the Joy of Cooking.
Good. Good.
There's a few little French treats for Bastille Day.
Okay. Good. Good. So, hats off to the French for giving us more wonderful, good things to eat. Celebrate, celebrate. We're talking about sweet things here. You have passed on, and I'm passing it back to you.
Oh, yes.
I'm going to grab it back.
The new cookie book.
There's a new cookie book. Tell us about this cookie. This is the prettiest thing. It's got the greatest information in it. I think it's great. Tell us about the cookie
book. It's called Cookie Love, and it's by a pastry chef named Mindy Siegel. But what she's done in this book, first of all, it's beautiful, as usual. The subtitle is More Than 60 Recipes and Techniques for Turning the Ordinary into the Extraordinary. And what I like about it is she breaks it down. It's like chapters, but it's broken down into like drop cookies, shortbread, sandwich cookies, egg white cookies, spritz and thumbprints, twice-baked cookies, rouglache and kolachkis, which Lana's going to talk about, bars, and then there's a basics. What it gives you is your basic dough, and then encourages you to play with the flavors, which I always like. And sometimes when you get these kinds of books, you end up, of course, you wander off and make your own striking combinations. This was the one, I think we talked about it once a few weeks ago. In the review I read of the book, I talked about in the thumbprint cookies, she had made a limbic and strawberry jam to put in the thumbprint cookies.
And I did not know what a limbic was, so tell us what a limbic is.
It's kind of a fruit-ish beer in the, I believe it's Belgian tradition. I could be wrong about that. But yeah, and those can be bought quite readily around town.
Okay.
Certainly at Wheatsfield or Hy-Vee.
A fruity beer?
Yeah. With strawberry jam. I like that idea.
Into a thumbprint cookie. Mm-hmm. I'm fascinated by this whole book. It has a couple weeks ago.
Alana is a good cookie maker.
Oh, I love making cookies just because they're fussy. And this book will like push me to the limit. This woman has a place called Hot Chocolate Cafe in Chicago, I believe. And she specializes in coffees and
things that go with coffee.
And cookies and shortbreads and stuff up the kazoo here. So they're lovely. Her chapter on shortbreads looked particularly lovely.
Yeah. I'm sure Lana and I are going to be reporting back to you various recipes because it's kind of inspiring book. Like I saw a cornmeal shortbread cookie that I think I'm going to have to try.
Oh, that sounds good.
And you're going to do some kolachki?
I'm going to give them a try. Now, she has recipes in here for something called rugelash and kolaches.
Rugelash, I think, are traditionally Jewish.
Yeah. Everybody has their own tradition of something sweet.
So Eastern European, kind of.
Eastern European. Well, kolaches are also Eastern European.
Yeah.
But this cookie book kind of takes those recipes and makes a very elegant cookie out of both of those. Her kolache recipe and the rugula recipe starts with an amazing cream cheese heavy dough, and that's her base for a lot of things. These two kinds of treats.
Yeah, and she rolls them out and cuts them then, right?
You can do lots of different things with them. And they're usually filled. They're some sort of pastry filled with all sorts
some
of
fruit-ish.
Things. Yes. And she has wonderful things, and the rugula is a rolled sort of confection, and she has wonderful suggestions for how to do this without totally getting yourself covered in goo. But it's a good book. I'm going to try some of these things. The classic cream cheese dough is pretty amazing, and it looks really, really rich.
Jeez. Oh, my goodness, yes. A cup of butter and 8 ounces of cream cheese. My goodness.
With two cups of flour. The dough itself probably is just worth just putting in the oven and just eat the whole thing.
That might be fun to make with older children, too.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's quite involved and decorative.
Right. Very. Mm-hmm. And making sure her little cookies are folded up. And when you bake them, the goo is supposed to come out. They're supposed to be runny and sweet.
Right, the fruit is supposed to run off. And
there's all kinds of things that she fills her cookies with. Strawberry, rhubarb, figs, cinnamon, brickle, blackberry jam, kolaches with orange blossom.
We still got a few blackberries going on around here, too.
And honey peach, honeycomb. Oh, my.
Now, the other thing we can encourage you to do is, while the berries are around, be sure to get some at least cooked up and preserved.
Right. Or another good way to preserve.
So you can do the cookies later.
Yes, do the cookies later. Another quickie hint for preserving blueberries. Put them on a cookie sheet and freeze them. Just put that cookie sheet in the freezer. The next day, take them out and dump those frozen berries in a freezer bag. Squeeze out the air, and there you have it. When they freeze fast like that, and it works pretty well for any berry, they preserve really nicely. And pull them out later.
And blueberries, as we said, are the absolute easiest. Low maintenance, little cleaning.
No thorns.
Yeah.
In my book. Now, this recipe book by Mindy Segal called
S-E-G-A-L.
Segal, called Cookie Love, is wonderful about cookies. But I was really kind of rather confused because her little chapter that included kolache did not really jibe with my version of what a kolache was, although it looked like it would taste the same, a very rich dough filled with something gooey and sweet. My memory of kolaches are from the Czech, Eastern European tradition. And kolaches, as far as I'm concerned, are yeast-raised buns filled with stuff. And those yeast-filled buns are always heavy either in the cream or the butter. Lots of egg yolks.
So that's the similarity, the richness of the dough.
Mm-hmm. But kolaches, as far as I'm concerned, are yeast-raised. You make it up and you let it rise a bit. And the stuff I remember, what do they look like when you do them that way? Oh, another thing. The stuff I remember is always a little bit of lemon rind and mace in the dough, rolled
into balls and baked, or how do you?
Lots of different ways to do it.
Uh-huh.
And I've had kolaches in different places. There's a Bohemian Czech traditions in northeastern Iowa up by Spillville. There I've had kolaches that are kind of like a big thumbprint cookie, a little round bun with a hole pushed in it, and that's where the filling is put. Also, there's ways of rolling it out and making little squares, glopping some stuff in the middle and folding all four corners. That's kind of a classic way of getting a dumpling.
So that's a kolache.
Right. And also you can make a kolache that is completely covered. A bottom and a top with the goo in the middle and kind of glue, and covered up so you really don't find the filling until you bite into it.
A little surprise package.
Yes, yes. A tradition with kolaches that I am familiar with is that there's lots of different fillings, but I'm familiar with the poppy seed and prunes or poppy seed and date. Poppy seed was a big thing. My mom didn't really make kolaches, but from my dad's side of the family, there was that sort of tradition. They were Bohemians.
Poppy seed stuff is very Eastern European.
Yeah, very Eastern European. And this was up in southwestern Wisconsin. So I remember poppy seed filling, poppy seeds ground, put with some stewed prunes and maybe a little bit of butter, vanilla, and cinnamon. And so it was just cooked down, and that was the filling. The poppy seed taste is really good. That shows up in a lot of little recipes. Here's a note that I have from a recipe book from the community in Cedar Rapids. There's a Czech village over there.
It's called the Czech Book.
Yeah, I have a recipe book called the Czech Book. It's got a double-page spread here on kolaches. Everybody has their own little take on it. Some of them are open-faced. Some of them are tucked in. And there's a writer that grew up in the Cedar Rapids community, a Czech writer called Paul Engel. And he was a newsboy in Cedar Rapids. He was selling the Gazette. And at the time, many newsboys were Czech, and they all enjoyed spending their money to buy poppy seed kolaches at the Sikora Bakery. Perhaps the Sikora Bakery is still there in the Czech village. There's a note here that he said, "My mother did not want me to eat any poppy seed kolaches. She was afraid I would acquire the opium habit."
Yeah.
"But naturally, I ate everyone I could get my hands on, and to this day, I still have not acquired the opium habit." So the poppy seeds are good for you, I think. Those are kolaches. The idea of the open-faced ones, the ones that are closed up, and fill them with anything you want. Also, I ran across a nice kolache recipe from northwestern Iowa.
In Farm News.
In Farm News Magazine, up in Pocahontas. There's a Czech families up there, and there's a kolache recipe with prune filling, and also the recipe is from Betty Hallberg of Pocahontas.
And the headline is, "Kolaches rise to the occasion."
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. Unlike cooks in northeastern Iowa who typically make open-faced kolaches, Pocahontas cooks fold the little flaps of dough over, filling in the center. So however your mother taught you to make kolaches is probably the way to do it.
Well, that's the best way to do it, then.
Of course it's the best way to do it.
Whatever your mother taught you about this.
So a little bit on kolaches. So does anyone else have any kolache recipes or kolache stories, kolache memories? What about kringla? What about rugla? Or cream puffs or all this stuff? Send us your food memories and food recipes, khoi@gmail.com. What's on your plate? What kind of stuff would you like us to talk about? Oh, here, I found a little something else about kolaches. Kolaches kind of came to the United States with the Eastern European immigrants. It's spelled lots of different ways. It comes from the old Slavonic word kolo, meaning circle or wheel.
And they're all with K.
Yeah, all with Ks, yes. Yeah. C-E-C-H-E-C-K-Y, all kinds of ways to say kolache. There's also a kind of kolache that made its way to Texas. And believe it or not, the one in Texas is called a koblaznik. It's a kolache dough, but it's filled with sausage or ground sausage.
Oh, it's savory.
Yes, it's savory. Nowadays they put in jalapeno, eggs and bacon, too. I've actually had one of these at the Ames Farmers Market. They called it a koblaznik, and yes, it looked like a kolache, but it had a sausage in the middle. So it's good.
Is that something currently at the farmers market?
I think I got that last year, but I don't get around. I'm at the booth myself. I don't get around to all the good things there. Yeah.
Well, I'll go looking for it on Saturday, and if I find one, Lana, I'll bring it to you your booth, okay?
All right. So,
sounds good to me.
Kolaches, cookies, pate choux. I think all that stuff sounds really,
yes, we need the sweetness in our lives, don't we?
Really good. Let's take another little music break here. You'll listen to KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. French cafe music there.
For Bastille Day.
That accordion music from a group called the Baguette Quartet. Yes, yes. Oh, that was good. I mentioned before about emailing us with your ideas, your recipes, your opinions, your food stories, your memories. What's on your plate? We'd love to hear what you have to say and what you'd like us to cover here on the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is community radio. We want your input. So if you have a kolache opinion, and I bet there's a lot of opinions out there. Yeah, call in.
Or if you want to cook some and drop them off for us, we'll have an opinion.
Oh,
right?
What a good idea. Yes, yes. Cookies. You have any cookie ideas? Summer cookie ideas? Summer is full of a lot of good things.
Good traditions.
Family reunions come about this time of year. And that's something else. If you have a family reunion you'd like to brag about, do you have a family reunion tradition? Certainly, when families get together, you do something besides disagree on things. I certainly hope so. What do you do at your family reunion?
Well, Lana married into a family that has a startlingly wonderful, creative family reunion. Tell us about going to the family reunion, Lana.
All right. This is my husband's mother's side of the family. And
what's
yes,
the family name for?
It's a Sabatka family. It's the Sabatka family reunion. And believe it or not, they are Bohemian, Czech. Most of them are centered in northern Missouri, which we go to once every 3 years. It's a big deal, so you don't do it every year. It's a huge bunch of people. People arrive with travel trailers. They arrive with pickup trucks. They arrive with things on wheels.
And it's a multi-day affair.
Oh, my goodness. They end up on a cousin's farm. We have a lovely time. This family is big enough to have its own zip code, folks. It's pretty. I'm still kind of reeling. I've known this family for a couple decades now, and I still don't know everybody. And they're all lovely, and they're all skilled in doing things in a big way. They are truck mechanics. They are carpenters. They are metal fabricators. They are airplane pilots. They do a lot of different things. Very talented family. So when this bunch of people get together, there are devices that are part of the traditions. One of the devices, and actually I'll just talk about one thing this week. I want to talk about more next week because I'd like to hear about your family traditions. So here is one thing that I'm still amazed at. There is a 30-gallon ice cream maker that was fabricated by some of the cousins, some of Joe's cousins, and not only are there stories and yarns and
30 gallons is a lot.
Yeah, and this what they there it's a big family. They're used to doing things in a big way. This 30-gallon ice cream maker sits inside a 55-gallon drum. It's got a homemade paddle that's about as high as the drum. It has been tweaked, it has been perfected over the years, and it runs off of the power takeoff off of a beautifully restored tractor. This year it was a lovely little Alice Chalmers tractor.
And so they actually pack it with ice and salt and pour the mixture in. And how long does it take to whip up 30 gallons of ice cream?
Well, with everybody kind of telling everybody else what to do, it takes about, 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah.
But the thing
is, you could go through a lot of ice doing that.
But
of course, it's hot, so that's perfect toy.
That's fine, and the tractor's chucking away. You don't have to turn it or anything. And it's just getting that thing together, and everybody telling about how it was done in the past and how it's done in the future. And there's always plenty for everybody.
And how many ice cream scoopers do they have when they start serving?
Oh, 2 or 3. It goes
30 gallons.
Fast. It goes fast.
Think 6 5-gallon buckets. Now, that sounds heavenly to me.
And it's
on a hot day?
On a hot day.
And do the kids get first in line, I suppose?
Well, I don't know. There's always enough. There's always enough food there. I'll talk more about family reunion traditions next time because it's just such a fun thing to do. And contact us, khoi@gmail.com, Donalana Kitchen. If you want to send us an email about what sort of things
your family. Outrageous family.
Yeah, everybody has outrageous families. And getting together and eating is usually something that happens during the summer. That's nice. Oh, also, what other things are going on? Oh, black currants. I picked my black currants, which is good. And you mentioned about making liqueur out of the black currant leaves. And I never noticed the smell, the
I know.
Odor of that's
they,
the
they
odor.
They are charming.
I
made my black currant leaf ice cream.
Uh-huh.
And this is good because you can do it before the berries are ripe and you can do it after the berries are ripe. And don't try it with red currants. It's not the same.
That smell is what you smell when you harvest black currants. And you're knocking the leaves. It's a really nice floral
it's
sort
lovely,
of thing.
Lovely, lovely. In fact, I'm going to make some more. I got some more vodka. I'm going to put more leaves and make another quart of the whatever it was called in Swedish.
Oh, my.
But the vodka with the leaves and a slice of lemon peel.
That recipe is on the Donalana Kitchen website. Go to khoi.fm.org. Go to the Donalana.
Yes.
Go to Donalana Kitchen.
Thanks to Ingrid Anderson.
Yes. And thanks to all the nice people that make the website here. Yes.
Little Bastille Day to go out again.
Here we go. This one is called Fibre de Verre, which actually translates to fiberglass, by a group called the Paris Combo. You have been listening to the Donalana Kitchen with Lana Noctical
and Donna Prisgintas.
With excellent engineering by Virad, we've had a wonderful day. We've been talking about cream puffs and basil and
cookies.
We had music from a CD called French Cafe. Enjoy summer. Eat good food. Enjoy life.
Fibre de verre, Je ne sais vibrer qu'en paratonnerre. Je suis condamnée à l'éclair, la poudre éphémère. Car si l'on m'aime, l'on doit me consumer. Mais demain, oui demain, j'en fais le serment. J'ouvrirai les yeux, mes deux yeux tout en grand, sur un bel homme, un bel amant, qui laissera ma vie sauve tout en m'aimant. Je me suis cassé les dents, le nez sur bien des affaires. De cœur trop pincé, de mœurs trop épicées, car...